If you live in St. Louis and flip on the evening news, odds are you'll see some variation of this story.
The deadly homicide epidemic on the streets of St. Louis.
Seven people were killed today and Sunday, pushing the city's death toll past
100. Another violent and deadly night in St. Louis. One man
dead overnight after three separate shootings. The first happened shortly after 9 last night.
Shots fired. Loved ones of the victims raced here to this area. They were very emotional, many crying and upset. Some tried to get to the body. Police holding them back. This is St. Louis's 151st homicide of the year.
And that number keeps climbing. As of early December, the homicide count in St. Louis topped 180. That's the highest count in almost 20 years.
But there's another number you can't ignore. More than 90% of homicide victims in the city this year were Black.
Now, we should note that homicides are only one way to measure crime, and arguably not the best way to get an overall picture.
But the human cost can't be ignored. Renee Whitfield's son, Rashad, was fatally shot this summer while sitting in the car listening to music with a friend.
He was my oldest son. He was 23 years old, a father-to-be, very proud. He was very quiet and reserved until you got to know him, and then he would be like the life of the party. Like, if you knew him, he kept a smile on his face, but he was really reserved. You know, he wouldn't say much at first, but after he warmed up to you, he would just be like the the life of the party for everybody. So I got a phone call from his girlfriend, and all I heard her was just screaming in the phone, and she's like, "Miss Renee, Rashad's been shot." And I was like, "What?" And so I instantly called my sister, and I called my mom, and I called my niece, because I knew they were closer to him than I was. So I had to leave North County, driving all the way down to North City in a panic, not knowing what I was going to witness when I got there. But when I got there, the first face I seen was my sister, and she said, "He's gone." And it was just like, it can't be. Like, he just left me. Like, it can't be true. Like, I know I just fell on the ground and I was just crying and I was screaming it just felt like a part of me just left my body.
According to the Centers for Disease Control, homicide is the leading cause of death for Black males between the ages of 15 and 34. And like many observers, Dan Isom says this is more than just a law enforcement issue.
Whether we want to say it's a public health issue or not, it is.
Isom retired as chief of the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department 3 years ago, and he was a member of the Ferguson Commission.
You know, if anything else was causing this much sort of damage, whether it be death or, physical injury, we would think of it as a health issue.
With that in mind, on this episode, reframing gun violence as a public health issue.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
A project exploring
race,
class,
power,
poverty,
systems and the people they touch.
I'm Camille Stanley.
And I'm Tim Lloyd. And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
So to get started, we need a little help with the definition. And with us in the studio is St. Louis Public Radio's health reporter, Duri Buscarin.
Okay, so Duri, what exactly is applying the public health model to gun violence? What does that mean?
Well, the idea is that you look at gun violence kind of like an infectious disease. The idea that it spreads and clusters the same way an infectious disease would, and that it therefore can be treated the same way through a public health model. And there are basically four steps that the CDC uses for any public health issue, be it public safety, be it communicable disease. It's first, you define the problem. You have to figure out what it is and how it spreads. Second, you identify what puts people at risk and what protects them from harm. And then you have to start developing and testing prevention strategies, figuring out what actually works. And after that, you can assure widespread adoption, and that's basically a big PR campaign.
So what does this mean for gun violence?
I mean, it really starts with the first step, actually recognizing the disease and how it spreads. So for HIV, back in 1981, people started seeing this really rare type of cancer and didn't know what it was until enough research was done. With gun violence, researchers are theorizing that you are at a higher risk of being a victim or a perpetrator of violence if you have experienced violence or witnessed violence. So that could be something like living in a neighborhood where there are shootings happening often, or it could also be something like witnessing domestic abuse in the home or being
so
a victim
like
of child abuse.
Like if this was a disease, then it would be like if you met those conditions, you'd be more likely to get that disease, right?
Right. That's the idea. But there isn't a whole lot of institutional knowledge about this. Back in the 90s, Congress cut off funding to gun violence studies that could be construed as something related to gun control. So most of the information we have about this has been privately funded.
Okay, so we don't know a whole bunch about this model, but is anybody using it right now?
Yeah, in Chicago, there is a doctor named Gary Slutkin who 15 years ago, using a lot of his own research, developed this program called Cure Violence. And there are now chapters throughout the country, including Kansas City. And basically what they do is they hire caseworkers and they hire young men who are sometimes ex-offenders or have a criminal history. And they go into neighborhoods that they designate ahead of time and really try to connect with people. And if they know a young person is involved in a gang, they'll try and bring him out of it. They will connect families that are struggling with resources in the community. And they go into hospitals where, in the case of a shooting, if family members and friends are gathered there, they will try and discourage retaliatory shootings because that makes up a large number of gun homicides that we see.
So what are the results?
The Chicago chapter of Cure Violence looked at two of their target neighborhoods in 2012 and 2013, and they saw a more than 30% reduction in homicides, significantly higher than their goal of 10%. That said, Chicago has a really high homicide rate overall and still does. And this particular program had its funding slashed earlier this year by the new Illinois governor.
Does St. Louis have any version of these kind of people who go in and do some conflict resolution with people from the neighborhoods or in hospitals or in things like that?
So one group we actually did a story about a while ago is called Nightlife, and it's literally a bunch of pastors who walk the streets at night. Three times a week between the hours of 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. And they focus on two different neighborhoods. And it was started by Reverend Ken McCoy, who's a pastor in North City. And I walked with him a couple months ago along the Hodemont tracks. So how long have you been doing this work?
Since May.
Okay. And tell me how it started. What's the origin story?
The origin story? Yeah. I pastored a young man by the name of Antonio Calvin. I baptized him at 14. And I buried him at 17. So he died a very, very violent death. I felt really, really helpless and hopeless because he was really, really, he was a good kid and had great potential. And he was one of mine, and I lost him. And so from that point, I started thinking in terms of doing something that was more direct to prevent another Antonio Calvin and to prevent another family from having to suffer the way that family did, and still are suffering because of his loss.
So we're walking, and Reverend McCoy has all of these stories about interrupting violence before it happens, and this one really stood out to me.
And we ran into this young man who was, you know, he looked really anxious. He had been crying, and he asked, could he walk with us? No, he said, y'all preachers, because, you know, we had on our clergy collars and everything. And said, yes, so come on and walk with us. So I was a little concerned about how, you know, how anxious he was. So I just thought, well, we need to pray for this brother. And we circled up and we prayed. And I held his hand on the prayer. And he was squeezing my hand really, really tight. This guy was really, really crying out, reaching out for something. And after the prayer, he backed away and pulled his shirt up and showed us a 9mm. And just crying, he said, man, I gotta really do this guy. I gotta do this guy. So I didn't know what to do, so I just grabbed him. You know, I just kind of bear hugged him. And he was like, what's up, OG? I said, man, no, listen, I'm not letting you go because I need you free and I need you alive. And I said, talk to me. And the group, everybody around me were just praying and trying to reason with him. So we asked him about his children. He said he had a son. So I said, what are you going to do? You go down here and kill somebody and wind up in the penitentiary for years and years and years. What is your son going to do? What is your son going to do if you get killed? And he just sort of broke down and started crying. And we walked him to his block. And I ran into him again about 2 weeks ago. I didn't know who he was, but he knew who I was.
How's he doing?
He's doing well. In fact, he thanked me for saving his life. I couldn't remember who he was. Because, you know, he run into so many of these young brothers out here, and I, you know, try to be cordial with them, and I think I was trying to get to the restroom or something. But he stopped me and made sure that I remember who he was. So that was a very, very, and it was confirmation for me, if we didn't do anything else, that that night we saved a life, you know. And probably more than that, because all the time when someone's shot, there's almost retaliation all the time. So we try to stay ahead of that curve. You know, if we hear something, we try to, you know, we're not law enforcement, but we try to talk to people and discourage people from retaliating.
So here's what we know so far. Gun violence often clusters like a disease.
And like a disease, a public health model for gun violence would involve four steps.
One, identify the problem.
Two, figure out what puts people at risk.
Three, test out some courses of treatment.
And four, let everybody know what works.
St. Louis has bits and pieces of this model in place, like the pastor's jury walked with, but there's not a consolidated plan for the entire region.
We also don't know a whole lot about how to do it really well. That's because Congress told the CDC in the 90s that it can't fund research into anything that could be construed as gun control. So given all this, let's now go to a city that's also seen a rise in homicides this year, Indianapolis.
Public officials there have a consolidated plan for gun violence that's designed to address things like poverty, mental health, and hunger.
Ryan Delaney is a reporter at WFYI, the public radio station there, and he's been tracking how well this works.
All right, so Ryan, tell us about the approach that Indianapolis is taking to try and get a handle on gun violence.
They're trying to take more of the long game, this holistic approach. I know those are kind of cliches, but that's sort of how they're going about this. They're trying to treat violent crime as more of a systemic problem, a result of a whole number of quality of life issues, be it lack of access to food, you know, unemployment, education, you know, this environment that is just a breeding ground, unfortunately, for violent crime.
So where did this idea come from?
It came from a guy named Troy Riggs. He was the public safety director here, came to Indianapolis about 3 years ago.
Right, and we should take a couple minutes to roll part of a story where you introduce us to Riggs, not in a police car, but in the lobby of a church.
Hey, buddy, what have you been up to?
The noise level rises as residents begin to trickle in. They sit in chairs at Center Court or lounge on bleachers, waiting for their number to be called. But to get the whole picture as to why Troy Riggs is here, we need to go back to 1989, when Riggs was a rookie cop in his hometown of Louisville. On his first day on the job, his shoes not even scuffed from walking the beat, Riggs' captain walked into roll call and gave orders about cleaning up a rough part of town.
He came out and said that we needed to step up patrols in that area, which was actually the Louisville police had that area. We were Jefferson County, but we were going to help Louisville police. And his quote that day was, I won't give you the exact quote, but his quote said, I want you to go back there, stop everything that moves. You can't trust any of those. And he used some expletives in that area because no one back there is good. Well, that was my neighborhood. That's where I lived. I found that pretty offensive.
And so Riggs promised himself that if he was ever in a position of power, he would never treat a community that way. So when he did become director of public safety in Indianapolis 3 years ago, he wanted a new way to gauge good policing. He looked at data that went beyond shootings and homicides to income, education, and housing. When he crunched the numbers, he found six neighborhoods that stood out.
We have 8 square miles we're talking about today out of 400 in the city of Indianapolis, where 4.7% of our population resides. But yet they live in areas where 20% of the homicides occur, 27% non-fatal shootings, 14+% of all mental health runs in the entire city are made in 8 square miles.
Riggs' big idea, make life in these neighborhoods better, and maybe crime will go down. He brought together 24 nonprofit groups and said, let's pour as many resources into these neighborhoods as we can.
Any area that's having trouble, that has a degradation of quality of life, and that's really what we're talking about. Crime is an after effect. When you look at this, the breakdown of family is one of the glaring issues in each one of these areas. It leads to a lot of issues. Lack of education, lack of coping skills, a lack of people being fed properly.
And so that's why Riggs is here in this gym, helping to hand out cans of corn and green beans with other cops and firefighters. A faint southern drawl still present as he greets people moving through the line.
How are you, sir?
Pretty good.
Got your hands full, man.
Pretty much.
Two corn and two green beans if you'd like.
Problems, like a lack of access to food, didn't come out of nowhere. Decades of heedless urban growth left these neighborhoods without the resources they need. Urban renewal displaced working class and minorities in cities everywhere, including Indianapolis. When interstates were built, they went through these people's backyards. And then there's redlining, a pre-World War II practice of denying home loans to minority inner-city residents that lasted into the 1960s.
We'll hear more of Ryan's reporting right after this break.
So, you know, I gotta say, this reminds me of a lot of neighborhoods we have here in St. Louis. So How is the new approach working? What does this look like in practice?
You know, I ask that question a lot to people in these neighborhoods when I'm out, and a lot of people just, some don't even know about this program at all. You look at the numbers, you know, that kind of the crime, and it's not really getting better. Homicides are kind of a mixed bag in these neighborhoods. Some have gone up, some have gone down a little bit. Overall, they're up. Worse, you know, shootings, you know, non-fatal shootings are way up in some of these neighborhoods.
Really? Even after all this whole effort's been underway?
Yeah, I mean, it started in January, so we're just about a year in. And this isn't really an approach that results in just putting more cops on the street. That's kind of the opposite of the idea. I mean, sure, when you have a spike in crime, you can pour a bunch of police officers in, and we've seen that in some neighborhoods, in some situations in the city in the past few months. But this is really taking it a long haul. A lot of it's going to come down to whether or not, you know, the community groups that have signed on stay signed on, and if community groups, residents in these neighborhoods, you know, really embrace the program. You know, this isn't the first time some sort of targeted crime approach has been tried. We've called them target areas. We've called them hot zones. The city now is calling them focus areas. And yes, it's a different approach, but you know, it's hard to convince some long-term resident that things are going to be any different at this point.
So if this approach is all about the long game, you know, obviously you need some sort of like sustained structure. So what's the scene now? You're a year into this. Hasn't there been some changes politically?
There has. We're going to have a new mayor in a few weeks, a new public safety director. So there's a big question mark on this, of whether or not it's going to continue. Since Riggs stepped down, he's now a professor. He left in August. You know, he's still a big cheerleader on the sidelines, is still going around the country trying to preach this to other cities. But it's unknown exactly what the new mayor is going to do. He has signaled that he likes this data-driven, community-driven crime reduction approach. But, you know, as politicians like to do, and, you know, any new city department head likes to do, there's going to be, you know, a new version of this at best, you know, a new name, a new motive. I've talked to a lot of crime experts, and they say, you know, the biggest thing about this, if it's going to work and going to work over the long term, is that baton needs to be taken up by some non-governmental community group, groups that are going to be here for the long term, longer than the 4 years that a mayor serves.
When we talked to Dan Isom, the former St. Louis police chief, he brought up a lot of the same points as Ryan in Indianapolis.
Now, Isom has been around a long time and seen a lot of different crime-fighting trends over the years.
Right, but he tells us this public health concept holds the most promise for a lasting solution.
It gets us in a frame of mind where we see crime as not necessarily simply a choice. It's a little bit more difficult to be very aggressive about saying this as chief because of the landscape of politics and the way community views police work. So, I mean, if I go into a community that has experienced 25 homicides and 100 shootings and you say, well, you know, police are not the answer. You all need to get the
call the health department. Yeah.
You need to get the social services in here and deal with it.
You might not be chief for very
You may not be chief for a long time, and probably rightfully so.
Yeah.
So you have to be very nuanced in how you deal with that. And so when I had the opportunity, I would talk about education. I would talk about services, but I couldn't talk about it in a way of saying that we absolve ourselves of responsibility of dealing with this, right? Because nobody wants to hear that. Now, you're the chief, you know? You're not, you know, nonprofit organization.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Get your offices in here and solve
exactly,
this.
Yeah.
So, I understood that as chief.
In his new job, teaching criminology at the University of Missouri-St. Louis, Isom can and does speak more freely about the public health model. Yet he says he still comes against many roadblocks unique to St. Louis.
Part of it is a structural political issue that we have in St. Louis, particularly the St. Louis City and St. Louis County being separated, the number of municipalities we have. I think all of that leads to it'd be very challenging to get the community on the same page, right? I do think there's a lot of momentum going this way, but here's the problem is this is really challenging work. Often in society, we want quick fixes. And so law enforcement is a quick fix, right? It's not a permanent quick fix, but you can reduce crime by putting more officers on the street. It's no doubt about it. I mean, I'm not advocating one over the other. I'm actually advocating for both. Mm-hmm. Is that let's put as much sort of hotspot resources into the area as we're putting hotspot policing, because we do need to lower the temperature, right? Mm-hmm. We need to make it livable. But we also need to deal with sort of those underlying conditions very aggressively, like you would with a disease. I mean, if it's spreading, you've got to be extremely aggressive about approaching that so you can stop it, you can minimize it, and you can change the course.
Okay, so where are we now?
A little stuck.
Yeah, because, you know, there's not a lot of research in how to use the public health model to try and reduce gun violence.
Exactly. Yet, there still are clearly a lot more people interested in this approach, including us here. St. Louis Public Radio reporters Dury Buscarin and Rachel Lippman, who you heard about earlier, are working on a series of stories that connect gun violence with larger issues in the St. Louis area. And you can hear and read more of their work early next year.
And we have to give a very special shout out again to Ryan Delaney from the public radio station in Indianapolis, WFYI, who let us pick his brain about the crime fighting efforts in his city. We'll have a link to his work at our website, stlpublicradio.org.
As always, if you like this show or any of our other shows, let us know. Give us a shout out on Twitter at WeLiveHereSTL or rate us in the iTunes store. It really helps.
And listen to the shows with your friends, your family.
Friends, family, dog, boyfriend, girlfriend, dog.
Whatever. It all works together, right? So just listen to the show with somebody and hopefully it'll get sort of an interesting conversation started. And again, rate us on iTunes. It helps us out. All right, so We Live Here is produced by me, Tim Lloyd.
And me, Camille Stanley.
Shula Newman is our editor, and Margie Freivogel is the editor of St. Louis Public Radio.
Our theme music was composed by Cassie Morgan.
And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.